from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an impending crisis among Michigan's home care workforce and others in direct care.
There's a shortage. Some people are in nursing homes and can't move back to their homes because they can't find a direct care worker.
Also, the Supreme Court makes a ruling on juvenile offenders sentenced to life in prison without parole.
It could give some judges the leeway in their mind to impose this sentence more easily.
And we speak with poet Diane DeSillis. She has new work exploring the moments when the heart needs help.
My heart has worked with sorrow and abandonment, so you're lifting the weight of sorrow. Just as you lift a weight in a gym and your muscles get bigger, so I imagine my heart getting bigger.
Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an activist on juvenile sentencing reacts to the Supreme Court's decision on life without parole for offenders under 18. That's coming up later in the show. But first, maybe you're getting older and you realize you need some help to be able to stay in your home. You call up an agency for a direct care worker, someone who works in the home health business, to come to your home maybe 15 or 20 hours a week so you don't have to go to assisted living or a nursing home. But the first agency you call says, sorry, we don't have anyone right now. Michigan is in the midst of a serious shortage of direct care workers. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton has been looking into this, and she joins me now. Hey, Tracy.
Hi, April.
Caregiving is a pretty big topic. Tell me why you decided to look first at the issue of direct care workers in home health, and maybe explain what these folks do.
We have about 120,000 people who work in what is called the direct care field, and about half work in nursing homes and assisted living, and about half work in people's homes. And there's a shortage. Some people are in nursing homes and can't move back to their homes because they can't find a direct care worker. And these people are crucial parts of our safety net, but advocates say they have really been pretty invisible until now, and we need to start paying attention. I spoke with Emily Diepa. She's working with other groups that are trying to bring more attention to the jobs. She's director of workforce development for PHI. That's a caregiving advocacy and research group.
These are jobs where people are required to perform physical labor and have a high degree of manual skill. They're also in situations that require them to be highly socially and emotionally intelligent. And they're also managing a lot of complex health conditions.
And she says, unfortunately, this kind of work has been devalued for a really long time, partly because it's mostly women and women of color doing this work, and partly because people assume it's more low-skilled than it really is.
You started by telling us that there's a shortage. Why is it that wages don't just go up through the usual market forces?
Most of these folks are being paid through the Medicaid program. So Medicaid sets the base pay, and they set it really low. So most of these folks are making $9.50 an hour, maybe $10.50 an hour. And the state, if it chooses to, can increase that rate. But typically, you know, traditionally, that has not been part of our state budget talk. I think right now it's part of the talk. I talked to a direct care worker about this problem. Her name's Misty Evans. She's on this special team in Midland at her agency where she'll fill in when someone has to call in sick or otherwise they can't make it in. And she stays mainly because she loves helping people. But she says that low pay means her agency has big problems keeping staff.
You can start at Target at $15 an hour. You can't compete with that. Economic necessity really drives a lot of people into other professions, even though they'd love to stay. They love the relationships they've built with people, but they just, you know, they can't make ends meet.
And it's not just the low pay. There's a lot of overtime, and most of these workers get no benefits, no paid time off, no health insurance. You don't even get mileage reimbursement for driving from one client's home to another.
Are there some other places that have had some success in bolstering their direct care workers?
Well, in California, Washington, and Oregon, direct care workers in these home help programs have actually been organized. They're in a union, and they negotiate their contracts essentially with the state, with a state agency. And they make a lot more than they do here. They make $16 an hour and up, and they get health insurance and some, you know, a little paid time off. So they still have a worker shortage there, but their retention is a lot better because of this, because people don't necessarily have to leave if they like it. So their shortage is not as bad as it is here.
Have home health workers in Michigan ever been unionized?
Yes. In 2005, the SEIU unionized the workers in the home help program. And, you know, it was increasing wages. The first contract they got included a 55% increase in base pay. It was really low. It was like just minimum wage. And, you know, the state agency that was negotiating with them also set up a training program. But that system was just completely dismantled during the administration of former Governor Rick Snyder, and the state legislature passed a law that makes it illegal for these workers to be in a union.
That sounds like it's something that would take a long time to reverse. What's next?
Well, advocates are feeling pretty optimistic that there's more recognition now of the crisis, even in the current Republican-controlled state legislature. They did approve a $2 and some pay bump per hour for these workers through September, and they are currently talking about maybe we need to put that into this upcoming budget. So, you know, it's not target wages, but it is a start. And then there's a big consortium of groups that wants to set up a training certification program, you know, regardless of whether there's a union. And one thing that really surprised me was to find out that there's like no federal or state requirements to work in this field. Nothing. There's no certification. So I think it's just another example of how these jobs are devalued. And one thing I'm keeping an eye on here is what President Joe Biden is proposing. He wants $400 million to boost caregiving programs nationally. At any rate, here in Michigan, we are going to have to work pretty fast if we want to keep this crisis from getting worse. The estimates are we're going to need another 178,000 of these direct care workers in the next 10 years to meet the demand.
If you'd like to find Tracy Samuelton's All Things Considered report on direct care workers who are taking care of elderly clients in Metro Detroit, you can head over to michiganradio.org. Tracy, thank you for this story. It seems very timely.
I'm happy to be reporting on it.
Many of our national parks have iconic entrances, beautiful gateways that serve as an introduction to the rest of the park inside. When Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore was created in 1970, Congress wanted a grand entrance from the south. A scenic road in Benzie County, expansive views overlooking Crystal Lake, Platte Lake, and Lake Michigan. 50 years later, few people have ever heard about the road plans, and some are wondering if it will ever get built. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanchura reports.
If you look at Benzie County on Google Maps, you'll notice a dark green strip of land between Platte Lake and Crystal Lake. It's about 5 miles long. That's where a proposed scenic road would run between U.S. Highway 31 and M-22, taking people from Beulah into Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. The land is mostly dense hardwood forest, and today, Andy Norman is walking it.
Ruggedly hilly, I would call it. And actually, this is almost a 90-degree descent here. We're going to go down, so we may want to keep our hands free.
Norman is retired from the Michigan State University Extension and lives nearby. After about 3 to 4 miles of rigorous hiking, he peaks a ridge and scans the horizon. Right in front of him is Platte Lake. Beyond that, the expansive blue waters of Lake Michigan, then the Sleeping Bear sand dunes north of Empire. And if you squint your eyes just a bit, You can even spot the Manitou Islands.
If you walk up here in a day like today, you got to have a good mood when you walk away. It's just gorgeous.
A quote, mood setter, is what Congress had in mind for visitors entering the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. When they established the park in 1970, plans for a scenic road here in Benzie County were written into federal law.
I think they envisioned a very grand sort of entrance.
Tom Ulrich is the deputy superintendent of the National Lakeshore.
So if you can think of the Pier Stocking Scenic Drive, for example, that's in the main body of the park and one of our most popular visitor attractions, you know, man, you get up there on that hillside and you look out over those views and you're really struck by, well, why this place is a national park.
But 50 years later, and the Benzie County Scenic Road Project is still nowhere close to being built. When the main body of Sleeping Bear Dunes was established, the Park Service could force property owners to sell. For this scenic road, though, the park can only buy it from willing sellers. That can take a really long time.
You really need to have that unbroken string of parcels all the way along the ridge, or the purpose of constructing a scenic entrance cannot be realized.
Ulrich says because the project was going so slowly, park officials actually brought the idea of the scenic road before the public in 2009. They asked if it still made sense to try to build it.
Pretty overwhelmingly, people said, yeah, that's spectacular stuff up there. That should be part of the national park. It's worthy of being part of the National Park Service.
But not everybody is in love with the idea.
I think we would all cry a lot of tears if all of a sudden we had traffic.
Pat Dennison lives with her husband Chip in Lake Township in Benzie County. They bought 38 acres of land back in 1998, some of it through the proposed corridor. Now, they knew about the road plans back then, but ultimately didn't worry too much about it being built. And they still aren't convinced it will be anytime soon. But if ever it is,
we would just have to trust that it would be done in a smart way.
Instead of a road, the Dennisons say they'd be much more interested in something like a bike path or a hiking trail. Tom Ulrich says those ideas have been brought up before and remain a possibility.
I don't think it would take an act of Congress, but I would think you'd want to vet that with the legislature to make sure that would be acceptable.
A bike trail is fine for the physically fit, but, you know, that's a small percentage of the population. And, you know, the National Park Service is here to serve us all, not just bikers.
Whether it's a scenic road, bike path, or both, it'll likely be decades before you can experience it for yourself. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The title of poet Diane DeSillis' new collection of work is When the Heart Needs a Stunt Double. That got our attention right away. It's a pretty relevant idea for the year 2021. As National Poetry Month continues, we wanted to spend a little time with this West Bloomfield-based poet, also a well-known gallerist in the area. In the collection, she talks about the difficult terrain of loss, figurative and literal heartbreak, and about marking out a path for survival. Diane DeSillis joins us now. Diane, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
That title is such a striking image, the stunt double, stepping in for a heart in need. How did you encounter that idea?
You know, it came from the title poem in my book. And that poem was about the moment I found out the father that I adored was no longer going to be around. I came home and my mother told me they had gotten a divorce, and that experience affected me for the rest of my life. So I wrote about it, and that's what I thought would be a good idea, if you could have a stunt double for your heart when you had moments that you needed a stronger stand-in for what's going on.
Will you read for us?
Certainly. When my mother said the word divorce in response to my asking where my father was, after she'd said he won't be back, I asked what the word meant because the closest association I could make to divorce was diving horse, an image to make sense of fairy tale magic plunging from its own dead weight. That day, having come home from school where my father usually asked what I'd learned, I learned I knew little. Me bedside, she propped by pillows reading a book, barely looking up when she said, "It means he's never coming back." I remember the whirl of confusion as if I'd heard a story read too fast to comprehend its meaning, trying to figure out how my father could make such an exit with no goodbye, the way a child might wonder how the horse climbs so high to take its spectacular dive.
Diane, how old were you when that happened?
Yeah, I was roughly 8 years old.
That's an effective capture of what happens in children's minds when they collide with a particularly difficult aspect of the adult world. How did you remember the diving horse metaphor?
You know, the diving horse, you go to Coney Island, which I've never actually seen them, but I've seen them on television, and you watch these horses climb up and just blindly jump off this high dive into a small pool. And so with my knowledge and looking back, I just paired those two to capture that sensation.
That wasn't actually something that occurred to you as a kid.
No. It was just to underscore how that must have felt for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
May I ask, did you see your father again?
I did when I was 15. So he had moved to Europe, and he was an independent management consultant. So he worked in Belgium, he worked in Venezuela, he worked all over the world, and his home was in Lebanon. And he took us on a trip to Europe and to Lebanon when I was 15, and that's when I saw him for the first time.
I wish there was a poem in this collection about that.
You know, I think there's one in my previous collection. There's a poem about watching him walk down the streets of the Champs-Élysées and how he looked to me. So I have written something about that. It's your expectations are not met when you idealize somebody. So it's a different experience.
It seems like this concept of a stunt double, you know, wishing for a stunt double for our own hearts, it seems like it's reaching for a way to dissociate from things that happen to us. Yes?
Yes, that's a part of it. When I wrote the book, I didn't know that I was going to have this rare open-heart surgery, just to give you an example. So they had to go in and shave my heart because the muscle grew too big and I wasn't getting the proper blood flow. And it wasn't something you could just go to any heart surgeon for. I had to go to Cleveland. And what happened was...
To the clinic.
And when I got there, they didn't want to tell me all the things they were going to do ahead of time because it's extremely stressful. So finally, I'm going in the operating room and the surgeon tells me, "We're going to saw your chest open. We're doing this, that, and the other thing." And I'm going, "Oh, holy cow." So then they roll me in to have the surgery. And suddenly these nurses come in and they're saying, stop. She can't have the surgery. Because they had done some blood tests and found out I had a blood disorder, von Willebrand's, which would cause me to bleed out. So I had to go home for 30 days while they figured out this. And I was left with all these thoughts about what was going to happen. And the stunt double would have come in very handy for that, because there was a lot of fear and anticipation. So yeah, there are times in life when you hear some bad news and it's just hard to take, and you wish somebody could stand in for you.
You've brought another poem I wanted to ask you about. It's called The Art of Kintsugi. Do you want to say something to set this up before you read it?
Yes, sure. Well, kintsugi is the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery, and they dust lacquer with gold to highlight it, and they want to highlight the fractures rather than hide them, and they also call it the art of precious scars. So this broken vessel is even more beautiful than it was before it, you know, broke. So that seemed an interesting metaphor for having the heart surgery. When I went home for the 30 days, I thought to myself, well, I don't want him to just think of me as some slab on a table, so I think I'll write him a poem. And I wrote this for him, and I gave it to him, and he liked it. So this is called The Art of Kintsugi. To make the repair, the surgeon must fracture the sternum east, west. He must think in halves to spread the ribs right, left, and then consider what is right, what is left. He must palpate the jagged edges of loneliness. Once I dated a guy. It was snowing. There was a concert. We were to go together. Words drove us apart. When he ran to his car, sped off, I ran after him, my hands clamped to the bumper, feet sliding in the snow, the zigzag of tracks, my EKG before letting go. In order for the surgeon to find the wound, he must feel the muscle that builds the walls that have grown too thick. Observe how hard the muscle has worked, lifting and lowering the weight of love and sorrow. To make the repair, the surgeon must admire the beauty of wholeness, cobble and collage, in order to form the gilded scar that marries the sides, smooths the edges.
Wow. Were you in a place to be able to be sort of gathering images and impressions, like as you were starting to think about your body in this way as a thing that could be broken in a new way and also put back together?
Yes, that's where the kintsugi came in as a metaphor. That's where the pottery gets broken and then somebody puts it back together. And because they call it the art of precious scars, I thought that was just perfect. That it doesn't diminish you as a person. In fact, it could enhance you as a survivor. That was the kind of image I thought of. And I also thought, when I wrote the poem, I thought, how did that muscle get so thick that it has to be shaved? And then I thought sort of romantically about it, that my heart has worked with sorrow and abandonment and this and that. So you're lifting the weight of sorrow, just as you lift a weight in a gym and your muscles get bigger. So I imagine my heart getting bigger from my experiences in life.
But then being needing a trim, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, needed a shave. So never heard of anything like that. But it's not something they do a lot of.
Can I ask, why poetry for you?
You know, when I was a young girl after my father left, and I'm not really talking about when I'm 8, but his desk was there and his bookcase was there. And he had these interesting books like The Ocean of Theosophy. But he had a Khalil Gibran's Prophet. Mm-hmm. And later, just as a way to be close to him, I'd look through the book and I'd see these very soothing poems. And I imagined my father speaking through Gibran to me because it was his book. And the response I had to the poems led me to express myself that way. And that's really one of the things that started me writing poetry. Just getting a hold of that book and seeing, you know, they have little passages, if you've ever read the book, on joy and suffering. And one of the things Gibran says, you need to carve your heart out, essentially, to make room for joy. So the sorrow might carve your heart out, and then it can be filled with joy. Or I remember a quote that said, your children are not your children. They're the longing of life for itself. I don't have that correct right now, but those kinds of things were sort of philosophical and, like you're saying, allowed you to be removed from the actual emotion in a more intellectual way. And I think that's helpful. And I also think it's helpful in writing poetry. When you're writing about something that's very emotional to you, it's interesting to use humor or some sort of metaphor to distance yourself. Otherwise, you can't write it. So it worked that way.
What's the physical experience of writing poetry like for you?
It is sit in a chair, and this is a cliche about the zone, but you sit in this chair and you pick up these ideas and impulses, and it just isolates you in a very pleasant way. And it allows you to drift and think and attach yourself to ideas. And if I don't do it for several days, I'm not feeling so good. It just is a great way to get in touch with yourself, so to speak.
Yeah. There's one more poem I'd love to ask you to read for us, and it's a little different subject matter than what we've been tackling so far. There's a fair amount of really funny stuff in this book. There's one I wanted to ask you to read called The Fist on Jefferson Avenue Meets Isaac Newton.
Oh.
Do you mind?
Not at all. I'd be happy to. The Fist on Jefferson Avenue Meets Isaac Newton. Drive down Jefferson near the banks of the Detroit River. You can't miss the 24-foot-long, 8,000-pound sculpture, a forearm that cuts through the urban landscape, clean as the knockout Joe Louis delivered to Max Schmeling. Dubbed the Fist, this monument to Louis might have taught Newton a thing or two. Imagine pulling back the sleek bronze arm to launch an unstoppable forward motion. A hook, a cross, uppercut combos coming at you again and again. His fist, fastest in history, traveled mere inches, ending in paralyzing explosions. His moves efficient, accurate. I've seen Joe's hands, felt the warmth of his grip when I stood up with him at a friend's Vegas wedding. Dressed in elegant white, he spoke with a soft tenor, had the searching eyes of a four-year-old who lost his father, someone ready to lend a hand, give away all his cash, even when it meant living in poverty. I wish I'd talked to him more, but I was young, ready to waste perfectly good moments, believing, like a pendulum, they'd return. Suspended in a pyramidal frame, the massive fist never sways, but it does set the mind in motion. Some say it looks cocked as an in-your-face jab, head-on like a truck rolling off the rouge. Others see it as protective, ready to defend the city that has taken its share of blows.
Mm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Sillis. Her latest poetry collection is When the Heart Needs a Stunt Double. That's a great poem.
Thank you.
May I ask, was that written on site?
It wasn't, but I had seen it driving home, and then I wrote it when I got home. Yeah, I was thinking about how it reminded me of those Newton balls that you pull, and they click, click, click. And
yeah.
So it launched that way.
I read recently that it's so crazy. Some of your poems are going to the moon.
Yeah, That is crazy. I found that out just about less than a month ago.
Can you explain what's happening?
Yeah. There's this program called Writers on the Moon, and they have 125 slots. And I happen to be in an anthology that was written in English and translated into Persian, but they chose that as one of the books that are going to be launched in a capsule. It's going to land on the moon, and then it's going to remain there forever for people in the future to see what humanity was like in 2021. So I was just dumbfounded to find that out, but they are going up to the moon. I think it's launching the end of July. And there's a webpage on Facebook called Writers on the Moon. And I also am redoing my website, which should be completed next week. So I've done a whole page explaining the process and how it's all going to happen.
I absolutely love the thought of Diane De Sillis poems being on the moon. How does this land with you?
You know, my husband took me to Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and I wasn't really that interested in going. I wanted to go to some museums, and he's saying, come on. So we go, and we're going through, we're looking at the control center, we're walking through, it's getting a little more interesting as we go along. Suddenly, they open these gigantic doors and you see the Saturn V rocket ship. And April, literally, I just fell to my knees and wept instantly. It was so moving to me because the idea that someone had the faith that they could take this gigantic thing and launch it into space, I looked at my husband and I said, this is the opposite of the word no, the word yes. So when they called me, it just blew my mind. I can't even tell you how much it meant to me to have this happen.
Diane DeSillis' new collection of poetry is called When the Heart Needs a Stunt Double. Diane, it's great to hear from you. We hope you and your family are safe and well.
Thank you so much.
Next up, the Supreme Court's decision on sentencing juvenile offenders and what it means for people in Michigan who were sentenced to life as minors.
Certainly, Michigan has the highest number awaiting sentence. Pennsylvania had the highest number, but their courts have taken care of this.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In a different time, feverish interpretations of public safety led the Michigan legislature to approve laws that sent some 360 juvenile defendants to prison for the rest of their lives without the possibility of parole. Over the past 10 years, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a series of decisions that unraveled the legal underpinnings of those sentences. In cases like Miller versus Alabama and Montgomery versus Louisiana, the court ruled that these sentences are unconstitutional. More than 100 people in Michigan have been freed as a result. Yesterday, the Supreme Court published a decision with one of the court's newer, more conservative justices, Brett Kavanaugh, writing for the majority, that complicates those years of reform. The court's majority basically said that judges need not establish defendants as irredeemable before they issue those life sentences without parole. What does this mean for people awaiting resentencing here in Michigan? Here to help us sort it out is attorney Deborah LaBelle. She has spent decades litigating on behalf of prisoners in Michigan. Deb, welcome back to Stateside.
Happy to be here.
So the case that the Supreme Court was looking at was appealed based on a 2012 case called Miller versus Alabama, where the court found that a judge has to determine someone convicted of a serious crime as a juvenile is incapable of rehabilitation in order for them to be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. It basically struck down laws that required mandatory life without parole for juveniles convicted of very serious crimes. How does this latest case, Jones versus Mississippi, fit into that?
So what Miller and then Montgomery said was that that a child could not be sentenced to life without parole without taking into consideration their status as a child, their capability for change, and all the attendant things surrounding that you're a child, you know, that you're not fully developed, that you're impulsive, that you lack a lot of experience and control over your lives. And the court said that only the rarest child should be sentenced to life without parole, that which was determined to be either irreparably corrupt or permanently incorrigible. Terms that many of us are still grappling with because the psychologists that weighed in all said, well, as well as the faith leaders all weighed in and said, well, how could a judge determine that? What the Kavanaugh decision says is, well, you don't have to make a finding on that. You still have to consider that children are different, but then left everything else sort of as mushy as it's been, frankly. Two of the problems, I think, with the decision is that it lacks an understanding of how it works at the trial level, and it shows a complete disinterest in how racial disparities and unequal treatment based on geography are playing out, for example, in Michigan. So we have over 140 people still to be resentenced here from, you know, having serving a sentence that the court, no one disagrees, is unconstitutional, and they have the right to be resentenced, over 140.
With those 140 some folks who are awaiting resentencing, do you see this? Do you see yesterday's decision having an impact more on those cases, or on how judges might rule on these kinds of cases going forward nationally?
I think both. Certainly, Michigan has the highest number awaiting sentence. Pennsylvania had the highest number, but their courts have taken care of this, and their courts have said, you know, set forth a whole number of things that judges have to find before they can give someone life without parole. Next door to us in Ohio, they took care of it in another way. They abolished life without parole like the majority of states have done in this country now, saying, listen, it's too fraught with inequities. You know, the judges in Kent County are giving out life without parole as if it's candy. And the judges in other counties like Washtenaw have refused to give it out to anyone. And so it has a deep unfairness and inequity, and it's racially tinged the way it's being given. And so this does not strengthen what we know that the court has held in a series of cases, that kids are different and they deserve a second chance. And in fact, it could give some judges the leeway in their mind to impose this sentence more easily, which I think makes it incumbent upon our legislature and our courts to strike this down as unconstitutional.
Deb, I know that you followed outcomes for those juvenile lifers who were resentenced in Michigan. What can you tell us about what's happened with that cohort?
So, you know, over 200 and 25 have been resentenced, leaving the what's left, the 143. I think it's about 6 or 7% of those so far have gotten life without parole. But that's sort of a little bit of an unfair way to look at it, because the majority of those cases, the prosecutors did not seek life without parole again. So the problem has come up that all of those are on appeal. Some of them came from judges that said on the record that they didn't believe in Miller and Montgomery. So there are a bunch sitting up in the Michigan Supreme Court that were awaiting the Jones decision to see if there had to be more explicit findings when issuing it. And Jones said no, but I am hopeful that our courts will say, okay, but we still have Miller and Montgomery, and they are still the law. And the law still says that the rarest of youth should not be given an opportunity for release.
What can you tell us about the lives of people who had their sentences reconsidered and who were freed as a result?
You know, there have been, there have been 80, 90, 100, about 110 who have been released. And others are pending parole hearings. Of those 110 that have already been released, there has been absolutely no recidivism, nothing. They have come out, the parole board was correct, that they could readily join our communities and their families again and be participating citizens. And they have been.
Deb, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And now, someone whose connection with this issue is very personal. Efren Paredes is serving a life sentence at Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater for a crime that was committed when he was 15 years old. We've spoken with him before about his advocacy and about policy for juvenile offenders. Efren, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
The court's decision effectively empower states to make their own discretionary choices about the sentencing of juveniles. It basically gives judges in states where this happens an extra degree of freedom to follow their own state's rules. What should people know about how that discretion was used in the past in Michigan?
Well, in the past, prior to the Miller ruling, we know that children were receiving life without parole sentences, mandatory life without parole. Subsequent to the ruling and then the Montgomery ruling in 2016, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court made clear, six times they stated in that ruling that only the rare juvenile offender should receive life without parole. Up until now, since those rulings, judges in this state have pretty much rejected life without parole sentences for juvenile offenders. 94% of the cases have received term of year sentences, which are sentences that will allow them to be reviewed by the parole board at some time in the future. So the number that of people that have received life sentences again has been small.
In recent years, we've seen the Supreme Court follow evolving science on brain development, agreeing that people who are in their teens are basically cognitive works in process. And that has been, up until now, kind of the guiding principle. Do you see this decision yesterday sidestepping that issue?
I don't. You know, one of the things that they made clear in the ruling yesterday, they said today's decision does not overrule Miller or Montgomery. They also mentioned that even though you don't have to make the formal fact finding that a juvenile offender is irreparably corrupt, if the person's crime reflects transient immaturity, they cannot receive a life without parole sentence. So that is still clear. And because giving that sentence would be a punishment disproportionate under the Eighth Amendment standard. So they have not removed that language. That language is still very clear. And as Justice Sotomayor said in her dissenting opinion, you know, because they said that they're not overruling Miller or Montgomery, sentences are bound to continue applying those decisions faithfully. And I believe that that's what's going to happen in Michigan. I don't believe that judges are going to reverse the progress that we've made since the Miller ruling, where only 6% of people are receiving life without parole sentences again.
Do you see this decision changing much then for defendants or people who are incarcerated in Michigan?
I hope that it doesn't. You know, judges have applied the factors in Miller and Montgomery pretty fairly. If we say that 94% of the time juvenile lifers are not receiving the harshest punishment that the state allows, I think that's a good record right now. Even the small amount of cases that have received life without parole, the Court of Appeals has been overturning those cases.
People may realize that there are more than 100 juvenile offenders who are having their cases and their sentences reexamined because of the evolving legal decisions on this issue. And the last time we talked, you were waiting for a hearing, and COVID had made it extremely difficult for the normal legal process to play out. Can you bring us up to date on what's going on?
Since then, we talked, I believe, last April. Since that time, 25,000 people incarcerated in Michigan prisons have contracted COVID. I contracted the virus in December of this past year, and I was one of the lucky people who was able to recover. So nearly 70% of the people in Michigan prisons have contracted the virus so far. I went to court in early October of 2020 for a mitigation hearing, and I will be receiving a ruling on my case for the judge will make the determination that Jones versus Mississippi talked about yesterday about whether I am entitled to receive a term of year sentence or if the judge would uphold the life without parole sentence again. That ruling will be made next month.
Did the judge who sentenced you make any finding of permanent incorrigibility?
In 1989, are you talking about, or are you talking about now?
In 1989.
Well, in 1989, the issue of permanent incorrigibility wasn't even something that was being discussed in courtrooms as it related to juvenile offenders. I was 15 at the time, and I was there's less than 45 juvenile lifers in the state who were 15 at the time of their arrest, and I was the first juvenile to fall under the automatic waiver law, which allowed prosecutors to automatically transfer me to adult court without having a hearing in the juvenile court. So there was a lot of politics that were, you know, swirling around this issue. My case actually happened 1 month before the Central Park jogger case, the five youth in New York who were wrongly convicted of a crime there and later exonerated. But the backlash from that affected a lot of juveniles across the country. And during the 1980s and early 1990s, states made it easier to send juveniles to not only to adult courts, but also to adult prisons. And I happened to be going through the process in the midst of that.
There are a lot of people who look at crimes committed by people who are serving life sentences, and they feel pretty strongly that those who were convicted should remain in prison for the rest of their lives. Efren, what would you want those people to know about your own experience?
I think that my experience shows that people, particularly children, have the inherent capacity for change. I've done a number of things in my life to not only progress and evolve as an individual, but to also help enrich the lives of other people. And, you know, we demonstrated an abundance of evidence of growth and maturity during my court hearings last year, which is what Miller said. You know, Miller wanted to know, said that judges have to make the tough decision between distinguishing the cases of someone whose case reflected transient immaturity or the person who is irreparably corrupt. And, you know, we showed a wealth of evidence to show that I don't fall in the category of being irreparably corrupt, permanently incorrigible, and forever beyond rehabilitation.
Are you in contact with any other folks who were sentenced to life as juveniles? I'm wondering what other people are telling you about the reaction to the decision yesterday.
I am, you know, and I'm in contact with a number of people, both serving life without parole sentences and even people who have been released as juvenile lifers and gone on to live productive lives on the outside. And many other people share my same sentiment that this case doesn't change the Miller or Montgomery cases that the U.S. Supreme Court previously handed down, and that sentencers will continue to follow the trend that has been set in Michigan and not abandon the language in those landmark rulings.
Efren, we know you have to go. Thank you so much for talking to us, and we wish you well next month.
Thank you, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good weekend.